why is Batman called Batman? Like, why is he called Batman? Now, I'm gonna have to make a confession here, and that is that I am like geeky in all kinds of ways, but not in terms of Batman. I know almost nothing about Batman apart from what I've seen in the Christopher Nolan films. So I've watched the film. So all of my knowledge about why Batman is called Batman comes from the movies. If any of you are like proper comic nerds, I apologize. This is probably all untrue. But why is he called Batman? Well, from what I understand about why Batman is called Batman, it kind of originates from a time where he was somewhere, possibly in a cave, and all of a sudden these bats like swooped around him, hundreds and hundreds of bats, and he was terrified by this experience, and he was frightened by it, and in a kind of response to that, he decided, A, he was going to confront his fear. So he was going to face that fear, this fear that he'd felt when all these bats swarmed around him in the darkness. So he's going to face his fear. So he called himself Batman as a way of kind of facing that fear and not giving into it. And then the other thing was he wanted to be a character who struck fear into others. He wanted to be a symbol that people would themselves be afraid of. He wanted to be the human embodiment of these bats who terrified people. He wanted to take that role in that society. Now that is, as I say, that's what I kind of gleaned from the films as to why he's called it. But if there's one thing I've learned, it's that Hollywood loves like an origin story. It loves a story about where people came from. Like, why are people called certain things? Why do they behave a certain way? It loves an origin story. And of course, superhero stories are kind of the prime example of that. I often comment on the fact that it seems to me that what happens with whatever the superhero franchise is that they do an origin story, and then they do maybe one or two other films, then they get bored of it, and they just reboot the franchise by doing the origin story all over again. Because they're often the most interesting bit of the story. Like, where does this person come from? Why are they the way that they are? And I wanted to start this week by talking about an origin story. I don't know if you know the story of how the nation of Israel gets its name. I've got to be honest, I'd been a Christian a very, very long time. I'd read the Bible through numerous times before I ever really connected this account with the kind of origin story of the nation of Israel. Like, where did Israel get its name? Well, you can read about it in the Bible in Genesis chapter 32. The end of Genesis chapter 32, you get the story of how the nation of Israel gets its name. And it begins with a guy called Jacob. Now, Jacob, for those of you who know any Old Testament figures, he is Abraham's grandson. So he's Abraham's grandson, and he lives a pretty colorful life, Jacob. He's born as a twin. He has a twin brother called Esau, and Esau and Jacob do not get on. They're very different personalities, and they always seem to clash. And Jacob kind of takes on these more and more elaborate schemes, culminating in this great plot which he has to steal the inheritance and the blessing that Esau should get for himself. And he does it by like pretending to be Esau. And you can read about that in Genesis as well. At the end of this point, he has to flee because he's scared for his life. He's like, he's stolen what was rightfully Esau's. And he's worried about what Esau's going to do. So he flees and he goes to his uncle Laban. And what carries on with Laban and Jacob is basically this ongoing story where Jacob and Laban are both just consistently conning each other out of different things, like trying to cheat each other out of what they own to get more stuff for themselves. Unsurprisingly, this doesn't end that well. And so Jacob ends up having to leave there as well. And God actually says to him at this point, look, you need to go back to your homeland. So Jacob sets off back to his homeland. But going back to his homeland is going back to his brother Esau. And the last time he saw his brother Esau wanted to kill him. So he's understandably nervous about this. He's terrified. And he does this, you can read about it, he kind of goes through all these different things to try and make it easy. He sends gifts in front of him, you know, like here's a whole load of gifts and then here's another whole load of gifts, just trying to like sweeten Esau up. And then he sends his wife and family away from him because he's like, well, at least if I get killed, they won't get killed as well. And so he makes all these preparations. He gets to the night before he's going to meet Esau. It's the night before. And I don't know if you can kind of remember a night before something you were terrified of. It's that night, and he goes away by himself on this night, feeling anxious and afraid and terrified. And you read this really bizarre account where this guy turns up out of nowhere. And, you know, what would you do if in the middle of the night on your most anxious night a guy turns up from nowhere? I bet you wouldn't do what Jacob does. What Jacob does is he wrestles with him all night. Okay, so he spends a night wrestling with this random guy who he doesn't know who he is. They just wrestle each other all night until the sun comes up. And when the sun comes up, the man says, look, you've got to let me go now. Like, enough wrestling. It's daytime. You've got to let me go. And Jacob refuses. He says, I'm not going to let you go. I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. At which point, the man responds, and he responds in these words. He says, he blesses him, and he says this. He says, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Now, that is a strange story. It's an odd story. But what you've got to understand is that is one of the foundational stories of the nation of Israel. When you are, if you are an Israelite at the time of Habakkuk, you're sitting around your dinner table and little Johnny says to you, why are we called Israelites? This is the story you tell them. This is the story you tell them about why Israel is called Israel. Where did Israel come from? Where did it come from? You tell them this story of Jacob wrestling with God. This is a story that every Israelite would have known growing up. And of course, that means that is a story that Habakkuk would have been incredibly familiar with. Habakkuk, for those of you who haven't been around up to this point, he's writing to the nation of Judah, Israel, in about 6th century BC, he'd have known this story. And what is the point of that story? When the person sits down and tells little Johnny the origins of the nation of Israel, what is he communicating? Well, the point of the story is that to be an Israelite means to be a person who wrestles or struggles with God. That's the point of the story. That's why he's named. The word Israel literally means struggle with God. That's what the word means. The word is translated struggle with God. So to be an Israelite means to be somebody who wrestles, who struggles with God. And so baked into your national identity as an Israelite was the idea that I am one of the people who struggle, who wrestle with God. There's a very real sense that what we're reading about here in this book of Habakkuk is Habakkuk just living up to his national identity. He's just being an Israelite. He's doing what Israelites do. Because what are we seeing here? We're seeing Habakkuk wrestling with God. Wrestling with how can God allow Israel to behave with such violence and corruption? How can he let this happen to his people? Wrestling with the idea of how can a pure God tolerate evil in the world? Worse than that, how can a pure God allow the Babylonians to be his instruments of judgment? How is that fair? How is it good? Where is the hope? How is God going to answer me? And so after all of this wrestling, after all of these cries of how long and why and what are you doing, what we're going to see in Habakkuk 3 is where does Habakkuk get to? Like, where does he land? Where does all this wrestling with God get him? Where is he at the end of it? After he's gone through all of this turmoil, all of these complaints to God, all of God's answers, here at the end, we're going to see what has Habakkuk learned from his struggling with the Almighty. Habakkuk has heard God telling him in chapter 2 that the righteous are going to live by faith. And so here at the end in chapter 3, I think what we're going to see is what does living by faith actually look like in a world of violence and corruption and impending judgment. So Hopefully you've got it open in front of you, 942. I'm going to read Habakkuk 3 for us now, and then we're going to see what we learn about how we live as a people of faith as we struggle with God. So let me read that for us now. Habakkuk 3, starting at the beginning. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on some instrument. Lord, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds. Repeat them in our day. In our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens and his praise filled the earth. His splendor was like the sunrise. Rays flashed from his hand where his power was hidden. Plague went before him. Pestilence followed his steps. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled and the age-old hills collapsed. But he marches on forever. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. Were you angry with the rivers, Lord? Was your wrath against the streams? Did you rage against the sea when you rode your horses and your chariots to victory? You uncovered your bow. You called for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. Torrents of water swept by. The deep roared and lifted its waves on high. Sun and moon stood still in the heavens at the glint of your flying arrows, at the lightning of your flashing spear. In wrath you strode through the earth, and in anger you threshed the nations. You came out to deliver your people, to save your anointed one. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness. You stripped him from head to foot. With his own spear you pierced his head. When his warriors stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour the wretched who were in hiding, you trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. I heard, and my heart pounded. My lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones and my legs trembled. Yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. Though the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes on the vines, though the oil crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The Sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to tread on the heights. This is what he's learnt. What does it look like to be one of the people of God in a world of violence and corruption and confusion and judgment? Well, I want to suggest that our faith always involves two elements. There are two elements that we see Habakkuk pulling out in this prayer from the end. The first element of faith is that it's rooted in the past. Do you see what Habakkuk does from verse 3 all the way down to 15? You maybe don't, because it's like incredibly poetic, so it's quite hard to follow. But you can at least pick up the tense, okay? The tense is the past. You came. Things were uncovered. Things crumbled. So it's all looking at things that happened in the past. He remembers times when God has come in the past and how when he has come, his glory has covered the heavens. He remembers God's splendor and power as he has come to judge the wicked and rescue his people. And specifically, I think what's going on here in this like incredibly poetic language is I think it's actually a retelling of the Exodus story. I think that's what he's telling here. It's poetry, so it's not kind of a very linear retelling, but I think that's what's going on here. He's remembering the time when the Israelites were oppressed by a different superpower, not by the Babylonians, who were the current superpower, but by the Egyptians, who were the superpower at that time. He's remembering how when they were enslaved and powerless, they cried out to God, and God, in power, came to rescue them. How he brought the plagues on Egypt to judge them and to lead the people of Egypt to let the Israelites go. He remembers how God parted the waters for them at the Red Sea and then at the Jordan when they crossed over there so that they could escape. He remembers how just when it looked like the Egyptians had them trapped in between the sea and their army, how God brought the waters to trample them with the sea. Verse 3 to 15, It is this highly poetic retelling of what God did in rescuing his people from the Egyptians all those centuries ago. And it is that past event, above anything else, that enables Habakkuk to continue to trust God and have faith in him, even when everything looks so desperate. To live a life of faith for Habakkuk now, with the threat of the Babylonians looming, Habakkuk needed to see what God had done in the past. Because in the Exodus, in the story of the Exodus, by putting his mind there, he gets to see some central truths about who God is and what he's done that enable him to navigate what he's going through. So in the Exodus, Habakkuk sees that God does hear his people when they cry out to him, that though it might seem like God is indifferent to the plight of his people, he's not. Like, that's where the story of the Exodus begins. The story of the Exodus begins with the people crying out to God and God hearing them. It says God heard their cry, and so he goes and raises up Moses to rescue them. In the story of the Exodus, Habakkuk sees that God will judge the wicked for the way they treat his people. He sees that. That's what the story of Exodus is all about. God's judgment on the Egyptians for the way they have enslaved and treated the Israelites. In the story of the Exodus, he sees a God who is powerful enough to deal with the superpowers of their time, be it the Egyptians or the Babylonians. In the story of the Exodus, he sees a God who is powerful enough to deal with nations and to rescue his people from even the most dire circumstances. In the story of the Exodus, he also sees that though it might not happen immediately, there might be this period of delay before God comes in power to rescue his people. You see, the story of the Exodus helps Habakkuk to navigate what he is going through. Because of what God has done in the past, Habakkuk knows certain things, and those things that he knows helps him to navigate the present. This is true of kind of so much of life. What has happened in the past, the things we look back on, the things that we have learned, the things that we know to be true, they are the things which enable us to interpret the present, to think about how we navigate what we're going through now. But we, as if you're a Christian here today, Christians, we don't look back to the Exodus. Because the Exodus isn't our story, or it's not our primary story. And actually, that story itself, the Exodus, was primarily existed to point forward to another story anyway. To understand an even greater story, an even greater rescue. We don't look back at God's great act of rescue in the Exodus. We look back at God's great act of rescue in the cross. We look back to that moment where God came into the world in the person of Jesus and took all of the evil of this world, all of the violence, all of the corruption on himself and suffered its consequences. He suffered the shame and the pain and the judgment for it all so that he could offer forgiveness to guilty people who deserve judgment. You see, at the cross, we hear Jesus say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." We see Jesus offering forgiveness to all people who will trust in him. At the cross, we see Jesus defeat all of the forces of evil, as in victory, he doesn't stay dead, but is raised from the dead, and then offers the same resurrection to all people. You see, if you want to navigate the present, you've got to understand the past. You've got to allow the past to inform how you interpret what's going on right now. And at the cross, we see some central truths which help us to trust God in what we're facing. So, for example, at the cross, we see the depths of human sin. The cross reminds us just how broken we are. And therefore, at the cross, we are forced to acknowledge that none of us are truly innocent in this world. You see, that's a truth that helps us to navigate the present. At the cross, we see the extent of God's love for us. This is perhaps the most common way the cross is talked about in the New Testament, as a demonstration of God's love. God is not a God who just says, "I love you." He is a God who shows us how much he loves us by being willing to give up heaven, to become one of us, to suffer and die for us. And so, you see, as we reflect on the cross, we're no longer able to even contemplate, to even imagine that what we're going through might be because God doesn't love us. Because we see the cross. He obviously loves us. He couldn't not. He wouldn't go to the cross and suffer that if he didn't love us. So by seeing the cross, we're able to better understand the present. At the cross, we see God defeating sin and death and the forces of evil. And therefore, as we reflect on the cross, we no longer doubt that victory is assured. However dark and broken and evil things may look now, we see the resurrection and we know that light will follow the darkness, that resurrection will follow death. At the cross, we see God himself suffering anguish and fear and confusion. And so we know that God knows what it feels like to suffer pain and anguish and confusion and fear. God is not a God who sits above those feelings, but one who entered into them. And so he sympathizes with you in your weakness and pain. You see, this is always what faith looks like. If you want to know what does it look like to be a person of faith, what does it look like to have faith in God in all of the mess and brokenness of our lives? It always looks like this. In the midst of confusion, when surrounded by things that don't seem to make any sense to us, things which we can't understand, we look back and say, well, these are the things that I do know. These are the things that must be true because of what's already happened. I know God loves me. I know he has defeated sin and evil. I know that resurrection follows death. I know that God has entered into this and understands what I'm going through. These are the things I know, and we allow those things to help us navigate all of the uncertainty, all of the confusion, all of the wrestling, which inevitably accompanies being limited human beings living in a fallen world. What does it mean that the righteous live by faith? Well, it means that in amongst all of the pain and the suffering and the anguish and the confusion and the uncertainty, we look back to the truth of the cross and we allow that to help us interpret what we're going through. So that's where faith always has to start. It has to be rooted in the past. It's that which transforms our faith into something meaningful other than just wishful thinking. If it's not rooted in the past, if it's not rooted in things that have actually happened, all our faith is just hoping. It's just wishing. Oh, I'm going to just choose to believe this thing. But no, faith is rooted in these past realities. But what Habakkuk then does is he allows these past realities to give him some hope for the future. You see, the past represents the basis of our faith. But having remembered what he knows about God, Habakkuk is then able to look forward confidently to the day, as he describes it, when calamity will come on the nation invading them. That's the hope that Habakkuk clings on to. He has seen God rescue in the past, and so he confidently expects that a day will come when God will again rescue his people and judge the nation invading them. Our faith fundamentally works in the same way. Our faith hasn't really fundamentally changed from Habakkuk's time. We have seen God win the victory over sin and death. We've seen him come to earth and live the perfect life that we couldn't live. We've seen him die and then defeat it by coming back to life. These are all the things that have happened in the past. And because of all those things we know in the past, we look forward to a future where that past reality is our reality. We look forward to the day when sin will ultimately be defeated and where we will finally be freed from its hold on us. Seeing Jesus in the past live the perfect life gives us confidence that in the new creation, we will finally be able to be the people we were created to be, the people that we want to be. Like Habakkuk, we can feel frustrated, even demoralized, that we don't experience that now. Every time we fail, we can be tempted to despair. But instead of despairing at our failures, we look back at Jesus' victory and then look forward to a day when we will finally be free from sin. Similarly, we look forward to the time when death and pain will be no more. We feel confused and frustrated that we still have to experience those things now. Death continues to unnerve and unsettle us. When faced with death and pain, like Habakkuk does in this letter, we wonder, what on earth is God doing and how could he allow this in his world? But rather than sinking into depression, we then look back at Jesus' victory and so look forward to the day when death and pain are no more. And so we come back to that great phrase, the righteous shall live by faith. And we ask the question, okay, fine, what does it mean to be a person of faith? How do I live a life of faith right here and now in the face of wars and violence and injustice and corruption and confusion and anger and aloneness? How do we live lives of faith? What does it mean to be a person of faith? I don't know what you are going through here this afternoon. Maybe it's a relationship breakdown. Maybe it's ill health. Maybe it's stress. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's death. Maybe it's pain. Maybe it's fear. I don't know what you're facing right here, right now. I don't know when you leave this building what life you are going back to. But the question that you need to answer and that I need to answer is, what does it look like to be a person of faith when I go into that? When I go in to face my depression? When I go in to face the death that surrounds me? When I go in to face my ill health and my fear? What does it mean to be a person of faith there? How do we live in the mess of now as the people of God? I'm gonna finish with, I think there's three things Habakkuk says that this means. The first thing it means to be a person of faith in that, it is that we need to remember that that's just what it always was like to be an Israelite. It's what it always was to be a person of faith. It was what God's people always were. God's people have always been those who in faith wrestle with him in the midst of their fear and confusion. That's why that's the origin story of the name. The story of someone wrestling with God is because that's what it means to be one of God's people. It means to live a life wrestling with him. The experience of a person of faith is often that of struggling to make sense of things in the face of fear and anguish and evil and all the things around us. That's not what you are experiencing there is not something unique to you. It's not new. It's just what it means to be one of God's people. That's why it was baked into their name. That's the first thing Habakkuk shows us. The second thing is that when we are doing that, what do? Well, the good news is that the truths of what God has done in the past and what he's going to do in the future, not only do they say, hey, this is normal that you're going to face confusion in that, but they also give us a clue and some help in how we experience those things. Now, look at what Habakkuk does in verse 2. I'm basically just going to do verse 2. I'm going to the brackets of this. So verse 2 and then verses kind of 16 to the end. Verse 2, look what he does there. He says, look, I've heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds, Lord. Repeat them in our day. In our time, make them known. He says, all those things that I've read about you doing in the past, all those things that I've heard about what you are, this is my prayer. I want you to repeat them now. I think we pray the same thing. When faced with death and pain and suffering and evil and confusion, we look back to how God has acted in the past. We look back to him healing the sick, calming storms, raising the dead, bringing forgiveness. And we say in faith, Lord, may we experience those things now. Like Habakkuk, we say, I know in the past that you've rescued people. I know that you've lifted them out of a pit, and I'm in a pit right now, and I pray that you would lift me out of it. That's what he's saying there. Verse 2, he's saying, I've read about what you've done in the past, so repeat them now. I want to experience that thing now. That's a prayer of faith. What you've done for others, do for me right now. In faith, we say, God, you've done it before, and so now do it again in the specifics of what I am facing. Just whatever you're going through right now, I just want to encourage you, pray that prayer. Pray, God, I've read of your rescues in the past. I've read of the miraculous things you've done, and I'm praying for you to repeat them now in our days in my life. What does it look like to be a person of faith? Well, it looks like first recognizing that a person of faith is someone who wrestles with God, that confusion and struggling doesn't mean that you've lost your faith. That's what it means to be a person of faith in this world. The second thing we do is we go, hey, God, I've read all these stories of your salvation. I want to experience more of that reality right now. And so you pray for that to come. And then the third thing is what we see Habakkuk doing right at the end from verse 16 to the end. Having prayed that prayer, he says in verse 17 what he's going to do. I am going to wait patiently. The end of 16. Verse 17 is one of the most memorable verses in Habakkuk. It says, though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vine, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food. Well, what's he saying here? He says, look, I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing your restoration happening. There's still no buds on the trees. There are still no signs of life. There are no signs of salvation. I see no sign of you acting. And yet, what am I going to do? Despite the lack of any signs, I am going to wait patiently, confident that you will. There are no buds on the trees. Doesn't seem any better. And yet, Habakkuk says, I know who you are, and I have seen what you've done, and therefore I believe that you will do what you've said you'd do, even though right now I can't see it. That's the life of faith. It's saying, God, I know who you are, and I've seen what you've done in the past, and it might be that right now I cannot see what you're doing, and I cannot see any hope, and I cannot see any signs of life here. But because of who I know you are, because of what I've seen you do in the past, I'm confident you will bring life out of this, and so I will wait patiently to see it. As we find ourselves in the middle of injustice, we look around, and we might see no signs of it changing. People keep lying about us. People keep mistreating us. People keep taking advantage of us, and they keep getting away from it. And despite the fact that there are no buds on the trees, in faith, we wait patiently for the day when justice will roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. As we find ourselves surrounded by death and we see no signs of resurrection, all there is loss and pain and anger and hurt and grief. We look at those around us and we see their pain. And in the depths of our heart, we feel no springs of life. We just feel sadness and deep grief. Still in faith, we wait patiently for the day where what has been sowed perishable will be raised imperishable, where what has been sown in dishonor is raised in glory, where what is sown in weakness is raised in power. As we find ourselves battling sin and guilt, and we feel sin's power enslaving us, as we see no signs of victory over it, as we repeat the same evil over and over again, we don't accept defeat, we don't give in to despair and immorality. No, in faith, we wait confidently for the day when all who believe are set free from sin forever. As we find ourselves battling anxiety and fear, constantly anxious about the pain we might experience in this world of sin, finding our life controlled by fear. Despite the fact that the fear feels too heavy, despite the fact that our anxiety shows no sign of abating, in faith we look forward to the day when we will finally see our gods. And as we see him, we will be made like him. And as we see him, we will love him. And as we love him, we will find a perfect love, which is so powerful, it's capable of driving out all of our fear and all of our anxiety. That's the life of faith. That's the life that Habakkuk models for us, a life of struggling with God. If you are going to follow God, if you are going to be a Christian, if you are going to become part of his kingdom, you're going to have to get used to this. Struggling, wrestling with God. It's always how the people of God have lived. It's a life where we see what good God has done in the past and we pray for him to do it again right now. And it's a life where we wait patiently for God to bring the new life he has promised. And where that hope, to take Habakkuk's words from the end, allow us to rejoice in our God and be joyful in our Savior, even in the middle of all the pain. That's the Christian life. That's what it's always meant to be, one of God's people. I'm going to pray and then we're going to sing.